he handed me the microphone, and I'm just standing in the field reading German names off a team sheet. I think certain people would have had a nightmare that wasn't too dissimilar from.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the CSI Football Podcast, where we embark on a forensic delve into a particular season of football, usually with a tartan tint. I'm your host, Ian Stephen, and for today's episode, we are heading transatlantic to meet up with a giant of his genre and a curiosity in his country, an American that likes association football. Please welcome Zealand to the show. Hello, Zealand.
Oh, hey, thank you for having me.
Listen, it's pretty obvious what the first question is going to be, but why, where, how, what, when is Zealand your name?
That's the most common question I've probably ever gotten in my life, because my name is actually Zealand. In my line of work, that isn't always a requirement if you're making like a YouTube channel or something. But my best I understand it is my parents got into a disagreement when they were trying to come up with a name. I'm like the firstborn child, so it was the first time they had to do it. And in a bout of frustration, my dad thought he would be clever and throw out a name that surely my mom would never actually like. So he threw out the name Zealand, which was based off the country they went on their honeymoon to, which was New Zealand, about 3 years before this conversation. And my mom actually loved it. And they sat on it for a little while and they went with it. And I've always enjoyed having an incredibly unique name. But the origin story is I'm named after the country and a frustrated father in an argument.
Not the kind of region of the Netherlands.
No, I've since learned of all the other places that I could potentially be named after, which would be the region in the Netherlands. There's also one in Denmark. My personal favorite is I like to tell people I'm named after Swaziland, the country in Africa. But then I've got options. I can mix it up. You just happen to get the New Zealand story.
Okay. So you make your living via YouTube and Twitch with primarily Football Manager related content, an incredibly popular game that's been going on for 20 odd years now. So you can understand Rodney from Rochdale being heavily into the game, but our sport of football, as we call it, is still growing in the US. So how did you get yourself so fantastically hooked?
Yeah, I think it's a misconception that it's not popular at all in the US. It just is not as popular as some of the other sports are in the United States. But a lot of people play it growing up. I played soccer from the age of 5 through the age of 11 or 12. But even though I did that, I didn't know what the Premier League was. I barely knew what the World Cup was. Like, it's almost like we're not plugged into the rest of the world in terms of soccer, as I would say, or football. It doesn't really bother me either way. And then I remember I had a Nintendo DS. I don't know if you ever remember this old silver thing that you flip open and had the screen on both sides. And I don't know whose decision it was, because it wasn't mine, but somebody bought me the 2006 FIFA World Cup video game for Nintendo DS. And my first memory of that is that you could play in, obviously, the World Cup. And I loaded in. And the loading screen going into my first match was the Saudi Arabian flag with like a freaking like a camel in front of it. And then like a Saudi Arabian national team player, because they were at the 06 World Cup, like volleying a ball. And I went, wait, Saudi Arabia plays this sport? Like, it was this awakening that like, oh, the world plays this sport. That was the first time I found that out. That was the first time I knew that. And from that point, I was always interested in it. I paid attention to the Euros. I paid attention to the World Cup. I bought every FIFA. I bought every World Cup video game. And through the video games, I kind of learned the sport. And right as that was happening, the Premier League became very popular on US TV because it's in the morning. It didn't have to compete with anything. So on national TV in the morning is just the Premier League every weekend. And the generation of US players that have helped carry the United States from a team that couldn't make the World Cup to a team that regularly makes the round of 16 is that same, they're my age, right? It's the same generation of people that grew up playing FIFA and watching the Premier League on national TV. So I got hooked on it from that. And then I got really good at FIFA career mode. And one of my friends was like, hey, you should try Football Manager. His exact words being, it's like FIFA career mode on crack. And I was like, sounds great. So I just went in and the rest is history from that point. That was about 2016.
Okay. I'm actually old enough to remember the very first Football Manager that I actually had an Atari ST. And there was no licensing for names. It was just random names. So my kind of level of addiction goes back even further. So I can understand that the pain and the delight that you both equally share. Is there a team in the USA that you actually support them in the MLS?
No, I don't. Outside of the US national team, I don't actually have a club, which is something that I don't want to say makes some people uncomfortable, but it's definitely weird to people. But the way I explain it is like, look, I the teams that I'm fans of, I grew up with, right? Like I grew up in Tampa, Florida. I root for the Tampa, Florida teams. I'm not somebody that, and I have no problem with people that can do this. I can't just pick a team and just be a fan of them. Like my first sporting event was a Tampa Bay Lightning hockey game in the NHL when I was 2 weeks old. I've been going to Tampa Bay Buccaneers games my entire life in the NFL. That's just like, for me personally, that's just what makes me a fan of a team, is if I have that reason, like I grew up there, I went to school there for college sports or whatever. But it doesn't mean I don't like watching the sport or anything. I just don't have a club, and I'm not MLS is okay. It's fun to go to a game, but I like some of the leagues in Europe a good bit more because I love how it's different from other US sports. I love the promotion and the relegation and the pageantry and the kind of wear and tear in the age of it all. So
has there been any influence from the teams that you've managed in Football Manager spilling over into real life for you to have an affiliation with?
Yeah, I don't call it a fandom, but I do typically root for, or like, you know, if I hear that a team that I managed is doing well, or a player that I managed is doing well. One that I always remembered is Andy Robertson, my first Football Manager save. And this is relevant, obviously, in Scotland in particular. I was Celtic. And there was a stupid reason, one of the most American thing of all time, where we were doing genealogy and it's like, well, where in Scotland was our family from? And we went to that area, and then the dude that was the bartender said that he was a Celtic fan. And so I was like, I'll just do my first save with Celtic, because apparently where my family's from 250 years ago, like, they are Celtic fans. All right. So I do a Celtic save, and the first big signing I make is this kid from Dundee United named Andy Robertson. So the moment he starts succeeding at Liverpool, I'm like that Leo DiCaprio meme, like, ha, this is the guy that I managed in Football Manager, and now he's doing well, so I hope he does well. Or, you know, if Celtic has a nice run in the Champions League, or they, you know, with Ange, they go back and win the league, I go, ah, good, you know, nice for them. So the teams that I manage, I root for, but just not in the same way as, like, they're my team. I'm not living and dying with every match, but Football Manager does dictate to me who I'm going to care about a little bit more.
Well, one thing that's very exciting is that the World Cup is going to be hosted in the USA. How do you predict the tournament will be received, and will you be involved?
Will I be involved? I don't know. I'm going to attempt to involve myself. I would love to. We're going to do something for it. I'm still kicking, you know, it's years away. I'm still kicking around ideas, but I am incredibly excited. I mean, it's a very rare opportunity to have. I wasn't alive in 1994. I was born in 96. So I obviously don't remember that. It's a once in a lifetime chance to host a World Cup. I'm going to go to a few matches at least. And I think it'll be received fantastically. I mean, the U.S. loves big sporting events, and the U.S. loves winners. I mean, the most watched soccer matches in American history are the U.S. Women's World Cup Finals because they're winning. The U.S. gets behind that. The U.S. Women's National Team, you know, it was always like, well, what are the men doing? Like, why can't they catch up to the women? You know, people that don't pay attention to soccer would always be asking me that. And I'm like, I don't know. But the World Cups, even when they're not in the United States, turn into a very big deal. I mean, there's a funny segment of society where, like, you know, I would say half to a little more than half of, like, total American society don't really even know the rules of soccer, don't really care. But when the World Cup comes around, they take the American flag and tie it around. You know, like, America is notorious for kind of rampant nationalism when it comes to things like the Olympics. And you know, like, people watching the Olympics and watching the, you know, the men's water polo team, they don't know the rules. They just show up and root for them anyways. And I think the World Cup is really the same way. I get texts from my friends like, well, I heard the World Cup starts next week. Like, who's our best player? Like, just so that they know what they're rooting for. So it'll be received amazingly. It's going to, you know, the crowd's going to be fantastic. The U.S. is also a country full of diasporas. I mean, I live in New York City, which is a particularly high concentration of people from all over the world. But, you know, if you've got 47 other countries rolling up, there's going to be a significant population of people born or second generation from all 47 of those countries. And so there's going to be an excellent, I think, more so than most World Cups, excellent support for each team. I think the United States also has a ton of stadiums, a ton of big cities. It's a great place to host a World Cup, and I think it'll be an incredible atmosphere. But as in terms of the long-term impact on whether we love the sport or not, I mean, I obviously insist that the U.S. does. It's just not the sport that dominates the national conversation. I think the United States goes on a run that could legitimately be the pivotal point to more than half the country paying attention to, like, Premier League, national team, all that stuff.
Well, we know you like conspiracy theories in the United States. Let's get one in early. When the World Cup was hosted in Japan and South Korea, there was a lot of people felt that Japan and South Korea were helped by officials to get into the latter stages. Do you think that could be a possibility? Could America end up with an incredibly ridiculous draw, having perhaps the worst team in international football called Scotland in their group, just to ensure they qualify, that kind of thing?
I hope Scotland makes it. I'll put it that way. Oh yeah, our group's going to be Scotland, Ireland,
Your hospitality industry hopes we make it.
Exactly. Yeah, if the Irish make it, they're going to put all three home games, and they're going to put all three games in Boston. That's the point. Now, I think that there is a natural boost to host nations. You see that all the time. I think even at the Qatar World Cup, my argument would be that Saudi Arabia was the host nation for that World Cup. Like, if you know your geography, it's 5 minutes from Saudi Arabia, and we saw them beat Argentina. I think host nations always get a boost. That being said, the general footballing world, like the general soccer universe, hates the U.S. And I don't blame them. We're super cringe, right? It's a secondary sport to us. So you definitely don't want to lose to us, because then you're losing to a country where they're like not even really paying attention. No matter where you get the ref from, there's always going to be that little nagging thing in the back of their head where they're like, but it's the U.S. I don't really want to give that. But the host nation, you're in pot one. The U.S. would be in pot one anyways, but you're guaranteed in pot one. So you're going to get an easier group draw, and you're going to be playing home games. And the U.S. does home games very well. I mean, the U.S. national team will be playing in 90,000 seat stadiums. That's just a bunch of drunk dudes from like Kansas screaming the whole time. And they won't even know what they're screaming for. So they I think we'll be boosted. Do I expect it to be the South Korea level semifinal run? No. But if it happens, I do expect for there to be a lot of social media movement to say that's what's going on. Like, if we do make the semifinal, I expect to be arguing and fighting for my life that we're not getting too much favorites.
Well, there's 2 points that I've got to make from that. Number one, there's an incredible affinity for the United States football team in Scotland due to you beating England in the 1950 World Cup. We've got very long memories, and we extend the hand of friendship for that excellent result. You will never guess the country that the gentleman that scored the winning goal was actually born in.
Might be Scotland. Is that?
It was indeed, yes.
Yeah, we're adept at borrowing players. What are we? 19, first World Cup, we made the semifinal. Finished third. Highest finish of a non-South American or European team ever.
Yeah. And, of course, you talked about America hosting games. And you have played an absolute blinder by playing your qualifiers in Minnesota in winter. Congratulations. That is just superb. You've got nations that, for example, once you get close to the equator, you have to play in stifling heat and humidity, and there's not any complaints. So if you can host your game in the midst of a bleak midwinter, then hats off to you.
Yeah, we gave not that I'm proud of this, I hope the guy's okay, but we gave the Honduran goalkeeper frostbite. He had to sub out at halftime.
He should have been fine. He was wearing gloves.
Yeah, I don't know what happened, but we thought we were cool, and then all of a sudden Canada's good now, and they started doing it to us, and they're getting absurd. Canada played outdoors in January against Mexico in one of the funniest looking games ever. I mean, they played in a snowdrift. I don't know what, like, Canada's taking it to a completely other level because they can go farther north than we can, and they played Mexico in a snowdrift, and I watched one of those Mexican subs coming in. And that guy did not want to be there. I've never been more convinced that a player did not want to be subbing into a game. He looked miserable. And they won the game. And so it worked. But it's payback for, like, you play on the road in El Salvador and you're wrestling in a jungle mud pit. It's payback for that.
Well, let's move on to talking a little bit about Football Manager then. So how did you make the transition from being a casual yet enthusiastic fan into being a professional content creator with the game?
So I was in senior year of college in the US, which is always a big deal, big pivotal year, because that's when you're kind of, you know, particularly in US culture, there's very streamlined. You then go to college and then you get a real life. And so senior year of college, I was already preparing for that real life. I was only taking one class. So I had a big job in February because I worked in sports. And then once the Olympics were over, I came back to school and I only had one class. So I had nothing to do. And I had just built a computer with the huge help of my friends who'd built a computer. It's basically adult Legos. You just buy the parts and plug them all in. And I had the ability for the first time to do that sort of thing. And Fortnite was exploding. And Twitch streaming and, like, video game streaming was exploding, really, for the first time. I didn't know what it was before then. And my friend went, yo, when we play online, we should just stream. Like, when we just play random games. And I went, oh, okay, cool. And so we would get on that night. You get on with your friends to play video games, whatever they are. I would turn the stream on and just stream it to zero people, you know, no camera or anything. It was kind of fun to stream it to the internet, you know, just a fun idea. And I'm cutting highlights from it in, like, Windows Movie Maker for nobody to watch. It was just purely for our own personal enjoyment. And I just kind of liked it. I kind of liked the idea. I kind of liked seeing the number. You go up the one every once in a while, some random person come in and chat and be like, oh, funny play. Well, yeah, it just appealed to me, and I went, okay, well, if I want to actually stream, then what do I know about streaming? And all I knew about streaming is that people streamed the game they were best at. For me, that I'm not very good at clicking on stuff, so mine was Football Manager. I played it in class, every class, after class. I was just sitting there playing Football Manager. Because it's so easy to just have it up on in your laptop. And then every time you open your laptop, you just hit continue, take some notes, hit continue, take some notes. And so I went, oh, I'll just stream Football Manager. That was the only thing I knew about streaming, was stream what you're good at. So I started streaming Football Manager and just did that as a hobby for 2 years. Did it almost every single day. Became obsessed with the idea that if I stopped, I would like somehow lose my progress. You know, we're up to like 7 average viewers or whatever. I just streamed it every day. Would just get on and play Football Manager. You know, I've got my like college girlfriend at the time just sitting in the background doing her homework in my room, and I'm just sitting there, you know, with water pipes in the ceiling, old building, streaming FM. And that was how it started. I it's such a weird line of work to get into, but I spent years just streaming Football Manager to basically nobody. I mean, there were a few people there. And then I got handed a YouTube channel by this one Football Manager fan site called FM Base. And they went, "Hey, we have a YouTube channel that's dormant. Who wants to take it over?" I went, "I'll do it," because I'd been watching like content creation self-help videos. Basically, they're like, "Yeah, you need to make content on other platforms and drive them to your stream if you want your stream to grow." It's like, "Oh, I'll just do YouTube." So I took over this YouTube channel. I did not know at the time that I would be creating my life's work on accident, but I took the YouTube channel over right like 3 months before the pandemic started and started making tutorials about how to play the game. So I figured nobody else was doing that in like a high quality way. And that just blew up. And ever since then, I've just been trying to figure out if everybody in the stream are bots that my mom buys to make me feel better about myself, or if they're actually real.
So how did you realize that you could transition from having a hobby that was successful into a kind of full-time career?
I mean, you start getting paychecks. You know, it's you start getting cold hard. It happens very quickly. Like, when, at least the way it happened for me was, you know, YouTube all of a sudden starts spitting out more money than your dad made when he got out of college. And so I went to grad school, right? I kept doing it for a little while. And then I went to grad school for, it was a 13-month like accelerated master's program. And while I was in grad school, I was realizing, I'm like, okay, I love what I'm in grad school for. It was broadcast journalism, and I always worked in sports, and I loved that. But I realized while I was in grad school, I was like, if I wanted to, could live off of this. Like, I am making a significant amount of money. Like, you start to, you know, you're like, I'm making a significant amount of money. You're working your butt off. I mean, streaming 4 days a week, going to school, releasing a YouTube video every 2 days. Like, I'm working like crazy, sleeping 5 hours a night, whatever. I've no one of those periods in my life where I look back on it, I'm like, I have no idea how I did that. But the simple answer is you just start getting the paychecks. And my idea was, if I make a livable wage, like I can pay my staff and livable for myself for a year, because it fluctuates wildly, like every month for a year, then I'll go full time when I leave grad school. And so I cleared that. And so when I left grad school, I was like, this is my job now. I'm out of school, and this is what I do.
Do you think you're working harder creating YouTube and Twitch content than you would if you were working a 9-to-5? Because I think a lot of people think when you're making YouTube videos, you just work for 10 minutes a day, the length of the video, but that's not the case. Do you think you work harder doing this than you would conventionally?
Like, it's different. I think if you've ever heard somebody talk about content creation, they might complain about how they're always on, or how they're it becomes mentally exhausting. It does, but it's because it's a different type of it's a different type of work almost than a 9-to-5. Now, I've had very limited experience in 9-to-5 jobs. My job before the one that I have now was in sports. So it was based around sporting events. It had weird hours. It was also kind of asymmetrical. But the pressure with content creation is the time. You put in a lot of time. Like, for example, today I wake up, I do this podcast, I'm then going to stream for 5 hours, lights on, you know, at least 1,000, probably more, hopefully more people there watching you constantly. You got to entertain them for 5 hours. And then, you know, you got to entertain them for 5 hours, not say something stupid. That's going to end. I've been preparing a YouTube video the last 2 days, so I'm probably going to try to record that, right? And then I'll be done with that about 7 or 8 p.m. Then I'll answer some emails. I've got, you know, we have a team of like 7 people, so they've all sent me messages in the last day or two, right? I'm going to have to go through those. They're going to have questions. We have a video that I need to review that's going to come out in like 4 days or something, but it's still in the review process. And so I need to review that. Like, unless I just decide that I can't work anymore today, which is a perk of the job, but you can't do that every day or else you don't have a job anymore. I will work until about 10 or 11 and then I'll just go to sleep and do it again. But I think the particularly challenging part, because like most of that work is like, you know, I love it. Some people wouldn't love being in front of people that much. Like I love it. You're basically getting a job. You're getting a performance review like every single day. You're getting judged on how well you do your job every single day. You know, the number of people that watch a particular TikTok, the number of people that watch the YouTube video, the number of people that attend the stream, the comments section, the chat. Right. Oh, you look tired today. It's like, yeah, I'm tired. Like, I woke up not in a great mood today, but I'm still like here because I have to be. So the real fun part about it is that your income is also like a direct reflection of how well you do, which I think a lot of people would desire. Right. Like how your income being a direct reflection of how well you do your job. You don't always do your job well. And every once in a while you drop a bad YouTube video and you're like, guess I'm not putting money in the savings this month, right? Because I and a lot of other creators always, you make enough money and then you hire people to try and do even more stuff to put out more content. That's kind of the, I would say it's like the Mr. Beast model, where the more money you make, the more people you bring in, so the more stuff you can do. But then that creates this situation where you need to generate a certain amount of income to cover all of it. And I'm always very safe in terms of advancing, but you know, the income still fluctuates based off how well I do. So it's just, I think it's just different stressors. It is definitely, no matter what content creator you're looking at, it's a lot more work than you probably think. But I'm not on a woe is me train. I think the hardest part is just being in the public eye all the time.
Well, one thing that's really impressive is you've also kind of moved into documentary features as well that are well researched, well presented. You get features on Saudi cash and football, the American domestic violence coaching scandal, Valencia's poor management, Juventus's David Copperfield accounting. So where did this inspiration come from to move into a more documentary style of feature?
I realized that my background as a journalist, I don't pretend to be a journalist now. That's a very important distinction. I'm not trying to take the spot of journalists. The way I look at it is I put a story together. I use videos and the research of the people that we cite in the description that have, you know, various people that have written stories about something. And I kind of aggregate it to tell an accurate story. That came from, basically, if you're looking at this as a job and you're like, okay, I'm not going to make Football Manager tutorials forever. There are only so many times that you can tell somebody to use loans before they get it, right? But there are only so many times that you can show somebody how to find a wunderkid in Football Manager. And so I was always looking around for like, so what is my long-term plan on YouTube? Like, what do I want to do with the YouTube channel that's beyond Beginner's Guide to Football Manager? And we made a video way back that has since been viewer restricted because the goalkeeper was bleeding from his forehead on the thumbnail, which is called Australian Football Just Went Insane. And it was this riot in of all places, the A-League, where some dude threw a bucket of sand at the goalkeeper, and they were like on the field and ripped the goal down. Like, I always thought the A-League was pretty laid back, but
I like the fact they've got a bucket of sand. Like, we don't have enough sand here in Australia. We need to bring a bucket with us just in case we need more.
Well, it's apparently they used the bucket to put the flares out. But instead, some drunk idiot picked it up and threw it at the goalkeeper and hit him right in the head, which I've never been hit in the head with a bucket of sand, but that would suck. Like, that is not what you... The dude was concussed. He was bleeding. And that video, actually, people loved it. The video did really well. And I was like, you know, that you have this kind of light bulb go off. You're like, we can just keep doing that. Like, we can just tell stories about the world of soccer, the world of football that people want to hear. We can find those stories, whether it's Valencia collapsing and people don't really know about it. The Wonder Kid from nowhere, the Solomon Islands kid that scores all these goals and nobody knows about it because he plays in the Solomon League. Like, all these stories that basically I find interesting, as I am a football obsessive. I'm always just tracking all of this obscure stuff and just bringing those to light and being like, did you see this? And putting that together in a story that's like 15 minutes long. And it's the same as the streaming. I'm like, I realized that I loved doing that. I'm like, I have fun putting these stories together. And then if the channels make more money, we've recently experimented with like, well, let's just go. Like, one of the stories was the Faroe Islands team that made the European group stage. So instead of making a video where I'm sitting at my desk, you know, studying this team, maybe we get a Zoom call with one of the people that helps run the team. We just went to the Faroe Islands for a week. And we're just like, how the hell did you guys make a group stage? And they showed us around, and we studied a lot of different types of travel shows so that we could put together our kind of our own travel show episode. So it's progressed naturally from there, but it really was the video about the riot in Australian football that I was like, oh, this isn't something that just I enjoy doing. It's also something that people enjoy watching. And then when those two meet, you can kind of take off with it.
And of course, you also branched out to start visiting some of the clubs that you've managed in Football Manager. You've came across to the UK to Taunton, which is also the name of a animal that looks Skywalker Road in Star Wars. And you went to Austria to visit Floridsdorfer as well. How have you been received by the clubs? Because you could be seen as a curio or an oddity, or sometimes clubs really endorse having this level of publicity.
Well, they're all for it. I think the media teams at Floridsdorfer and Taunton in particular were very excited. The media team at Floridsdorfer was the one that kind of opened the door, because you're never really aware when you do this job of the potential impact that you have. Like, I'm always surprised. Like, anytime there's a managerial opening, there's this Twitter account called Out of Context Football Manager. Like, anytime there's a managerial opening, they'll just tweet a picture of my face. It just says, like, well, you have the man for the job. And it'll get like 7,000 likes. And I am, you know, I'm just not really aware. Like, I'm sitting here in sweatpants, like, not really aware that many people even know who I am. And so I was unaware of the potential impact I could have, or the fact that the clubs would even welcome me, until Floridsdorfer went, hey, if you wanted to come over here, we'd like roll out the red carpet. And I went, okay. We had no idea what we were doing. The videos we made, particularly at Floridsdorfer, because it was the first time we were like a traveling circus. I don't think, relative to what we could do now, we're not good at all. They were still plenty okay. But I've been received fantastically. I mean, I think the clubs they realize that it's a great opportunity. I feel bizarre because it doesn't really affect my choosing of a save at all. I still pick my Football Manager saves the same way anybody else does. I just scroll through the teams until I find one with a funny name, and then I just go with that one. So I've been received tremendously. The one at Taunton was unique in that England is a hub of Football Manager. It's a hub of my viewer base. And when we went to Taunton, everybody knew we were going to Taunton, and people came to the game just to see me. It was really the first, like, I don't want to, the way my brother called it is, he's like, this is like Zealand Con. Like, there's just, you know, people here just to see with you.
People dressing up as you.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was wild. It was the first time I'd ever been in that situation. You know, I remember I had somebody coming up to me, like, it was him and his son, like, oh yeah, we took the train 3 hours because my son just really wanted to meet you. I'm like, that is insane, right? But at the same time, at that point, you feel like almost obligated. You're like, yes, awesome. So you spend like 10 minutes with the son, and he's a really nice kid, and you take a bunch of pictures with him. And I didn't watch much of the game, to be perfectly honest with you, because I was just talking to people most of the time. But both of those instances have been great. I will say the old people at Floridsdorfer, because there's definitely like an old fan group. There's a young fan group as well, but there's like this group of people that have been going to Floridsdorfer games for their whole life. They were very confused as to what I was doing there. It was kind of fun. And they were, you know, they speak German. They don't really speak English, which is totally fine. I'm not offended by that at all. But there was also a language barrier. So I tried to endear myself to them. Floridsdorfer had me announce the starting lineup for the teams. So I tried to do it with my best German accent, and they did think that was funny. Even if they didn't know who I was.
There's no way to do that without sounding racist, though, like putting on a German accent.
No, just like, I just started it with a Guten Tag, and they all started laughing, and we just took off from there. You know, they're like, and you know, he introduced me in German. I don't know what he said, but I heard the word New York, and I was like, oh, they're going to, okay. Because I had just moved to New York at the time, and they would have had a nightmare that wasn't too dissimilar from.
Well, to put this into context, this is exactly like Taylor Swift turning up at the Kansas City Chiefs games.
Exactly like that. 100% like that, yeah. I did make Austrian television. That was... I did... I don't know if... This was a unique experience for me, but I watched an interview of myself with German subtitles on it, because obviously the audience is German. Well, Austrian, but speaking German, and I'm answering the questions in English, and so they're translating for their audience. And so there's this whole interview on TV when we watched it later, which just me talking in English and the German subtitles popping up underneath.
Well, I can beat that. I was actually interviewed on American television, and they had to put up English subtitles for me because they didn't think anybody could understand what I was saying. So
It is. My brother struggles with it too. We did a video about a Scottish team, like one of those research videos, and my brother was subtitling it and got some of the subtitles wrong. I had to go back and be like, no, he's not saying that. This is what he said. Like, that's not what he said. Because even he was misunderstanding what the guy was saying in the interview. So the Scottish accent and the American ear have drifted far apart over the years. That's for sure.
Well, we are a Scottish podcast, and you have been to Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
You've Baltimore. Been to the most famous stadium in the world to watch a international football game. Mm-hmm. What was your experience like going to Hampden?
I loved it. I mean, I really, really loved it. I was told that they hate Hampden. And I get it, because you're about a mile and a half away from the actual game. But the atmosphere in the most stadiums in the U.S. are segmented. You have, like, sections. Yeah, I know, and there's technically seating sections in Hampden. But this feeling of just this giant circle, where it almost feels like the Coliseum. I think it's a great... I thought it was a great place to watch a match. The atmosphere was great. It was also Scotland versus Ireland in the Nations League. And I mean, so it was edgy. Right. People were ready. It wasn't like Scotland was playing some random team like Austria, you know, where there was a bit more of an edge to it because it was Scotland and Ireland. And there's that kind of familiarity. But I really, really enjoyed it. We got there late, but a Flower of Scotland in like the 80 whatever minute that they sing it was really it was really cool. It was very different from a sporting experience in the United States in a good way that I found really exciting. I would go back. I liked Hampden a lot.
Are you tempted to head over for the Euros in Germany?
I'm always tempted. That's the tricky thing is, like, I know AFCON is going on right now. And I'm like, well, what is stopping me from just going to the African final? Like, nothing, technically. But also, like, the schedule of videos we have in the stream. You know, I'm like, okay. But the freedom that this job allows you, and that I can every once in a blue moon just go, we're going, we're filming a video there right now, let's go. The funny thing is, the Euros do feel so far away, in a sense. I feel like I'm probably planned like 2 months out, and the Euros are like, they're in the fog of war for me. They're beyond the pale. Now, I do have like creator friends in Germany, so maybe I'll sneak over for a game. I freaking love the Euros. But at the same time, at the exact same time, Copa America is going to be going on in the United States. And the U.S. is in Copa America. And so maybe we'll just be doing all-day watch-alongs right here at the Battle Station. I haven't decided yet, but I would like to go to one of the U.S. games in Copa America. Like, when, you know, when we're beating Brazil in the final, that's where we're going.
That is one of the nations in the world that we've never beaten. Brazil and Italy, Scotland have never beaten. We've beaten everyone else, just those two. We can't get over that hump.
Yeah, you're not the only one, I think. I'm sure we've never beaten Brazil either. So.
Well, that brings us to the end of another episode. My thanks to Zealand, displaying impeccable manners and diplomacy, pronouncing the word aluminium correctly for the entire duration. Please check his channel on Twitch and at YouTube. He's also on Twitter at The Old Zealand. Our website is csi.com, where you can find all of our socials. But until next week, goodbye.